Welcome to the Math Ed Podcast. My name is Sam Otten from the University of Missouri, and today I am joined by Charisma Morton, who's an assistant professor in the Department of Teacher Education and Administration at the University of North Texas. Charisma, thanks so much for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me.
We're going to be talking about Charisma's recent article in the Journal for Research in Mathematics Education, and that article was entitled, Who Gets In? Examining Inequality in Eighth Grade Algebra. But Charisma, before we get to the article, which I'm very excited to talk about, because I do think the placement of 8th grade algebra and how students might get tracked into different algebra courses, I think that's really a crucial topic in secondary mathematics education, but really mathematics education overall. So I want to get to that topic, but I always like to start with a little bit of background. So I was wondering if you could just share with us a little bit about your graduate experience and who you worked with in graduate school.
Yeah, so I went to the University of Texas in Austin, and I was a part of the STEM education department within curriculum and instruction. I started a doctoral program after being a high school math teacher for 10 years. And when I was, I guess, shopping around for doctoral programs, I was really interested in being part of a program that had a really strong equity focus because my research interests were really centered around issues of equity. Although at that time, they were nowhere near refined. And so when I started at UT Austin, I had the pleasure of working with Dr. Catherine Riegel-Crum as a research assistant following my first year. And I continued working with her until I finished my doctoral degree. Catherine Riegel-Crum is the co-author on this piece. One of the things that I guess I can talk about in terms of my grad school experience was that I really felt like Catherine, as well as the other faculty members in the department, looked at me as a whole person. And so I feel that oftentimes in academia, we are very much focused on publishing and teaching and, being great scholars. But I felt like in that program, I was able to flourish because I was seen as a multi-dimensional individual who had multiple identities. And so one of the identities that's very important to me is that I'm a mom. I am a mother of two boys, and I'm also a wife. And so I had a life outside of the academy, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so I felt like having Catherine specifically as a mentor and as an advisor was very helpful for me because she was also a mom and hadn't experienced what I was experiencing in terms of trying to balance it all. There was just so much support for me in that regard. And so I was able to bring my entire self to the academy, my entire self to my program. Also, my teaching experience was valued. And so I always felt like I had a voice. And so under those conditions, I was just really able to thrive and really able to answer some of these questions that I was really, really interested in. I did get the preparation I needed in terms of, how to publish and how to write and all of that and data analysis and the like. But I wouldn't have been able to do any of that if I hadn't received that type of mentorship. So, I'm very grateful for that experience.
No, I think that's wonderful. And it reminds me of Lauren Baucom, who was at PM&A last fall, mm-hmm. and she gave a plenary where she talked about how important it is to be able to bring your whole self and how it can marginalize certain people if they feel like they can't bring their whole selves in.
Absolutely.
Her talk should be available on YouTube very soon from PM&A, so that's something people can look for. And yeah, I definitely just think it is really important. We can sometimes in academia get just overblown on some of the productivity kinds of things. And it's really important to recognize the whole person. And that was one of the reasons I really wanted to come to the University of Missouri was I really got that family feel because I also have children and a spouse. And so for me, it was important that, I love work, but I also want to keep it in balance with other things. And I felt like my institution also supported that and supported children and family and that balance. So I think it is, we can't lose sight of it. Even when we get into the nitty gritty of research, we have to keep sight of everything else.
Absolutely. And another thing to add to that is I feel that, and I'm a huge champion for this. We have to change the culture, right? Because we want to be more inclusive and we want to welcome multiple perspectives. We have to consider multiple backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And so, I feel that from my mentorship, I now have the ability where I am at the University of North Texas to pay it forward, if you will, and be the same type of mentor that I had to other grad students, you know, because for too long, a lot of students or a lot of people have been locked out of the academy because we don't consider the academy to be our lives, right? It's a part of what we do and it's informed by things that we care about. So,
Well, with that said, let's go into JRME, the premier research journal in math education, your piece that was written. But no, I do think this is a very important study that I do really want to talk to you about. So in JRME, who gets in, examining inequality in eighth grade algebra. So what was the origin of this particular study? How did you come about writing and working on this?
Well, if I'm going to talk about the origin, I have to go back. I have to go way back to my high school math teaching days. And so I taught for 10 years as a math teacher in a predominantly Black and Latinx Title I high school in the United States Virgin Islands. So through that experience, I taught everything from Algebra 1 to Advanced Placement Calculus. And one of the things that I noticed was that as students were progressing through the math course taking pipeline, fewer and fewer of them were choosing to take advanced math courses. And that really bothered me. I was bothered by it because I knew that this would severely limit their educational opportunities moving forward in terms of advanced course taking and in terms of the types of majors that they would have if they do go to college. And so I was really bothered by that trend. At the time, I guess I didn't really have the tools to figure out why that was an issue or why that was actually happening. And so I entered grad school with these specific interests in mind. I was really interested in these mechanisms at play on the structural level that impact course-taking patterns for students of color in particular. And so this paper comes out of my dissertation study, which focused on 8th grade algebra specifically. As we know, algebra is considered a gatekeeper to more favorable outcomes for students. And we also know that there's been a push for algebra to be taken earlier and earlier. And so for the most part, we have a lot of students who are taking algebra in the 8th grade. And so I thought that that would be a good backdrop or a good context to really be thinking about what the opportunities look like for students of color. And so my dissertation had three parts. The first was thinking about issues of access for students by race to this course. And then the second was thinking about what their experiences are once they're in the course. And then finally thinking about outcomes related to completion of the course. So this paper is the first analytic piece of that dissertation.
Yeah, and I'm looking too at the research question about you're really trying to investigate to what extent do racial disparities in prior opportunities to learn explain the subsequent inequality in access to 8th grade algebra? And then you're looking at the context that we'll talk about in a second. But yeah, I think that's this really important question of we see these racial disparities in course taking. And how much of that can we trace back to some inequities in the opportunities that they had before that leading up to it. So there's kind of this, you know, multidimensionality to the way that there can be racialized differences in opportunities and things. Right. I wonder if you could set the stage for us a little bit in terms of, you mentioned where you were teaching and in your background. Tell us a little bit about the setting and then the data that you collected for this particular study.
The data for this study, I was part of a research group while I was in graduate school, where we were collecting data related to students' interests in math and science careers. And as part of that research study, we were able to collect transcript data for this particular district. And so this district is a large urban school district in the Southwest. What's really great about this particular district is that it's largely made up of students from minoritized populations, specifically Black and Hispanic students. And so it's really a great district to be looking at racial disparities in educational outcomes And so for this particular study, I focus on, or we focus on about 10,500 students who were eighth graders in the 2010, 2011, or 2011 to 2012 school year. Something else I guess I should mention about this particular district is that about 72% of students qualify for free and reduced lunch. Within that school district, the vast majority of the schools would be classified as having more than 60% Hispanic students. And so far less of those schools are what we would call racially integrated. And then very, very, very few would fall into the category of predominantly Black or other.
I'm speaking with Charisma Morton from the University of North Texas. And so with that kind of setup, let's just go ahead and dive into some of the things that you found. So if we look at the overarching level, just kind of descriptive statistics that you got from that data, what were some of the things that you found with regard to course placement?
Yeah, so I think it's super interesting to think about these two different school contexts. And so thinking about racially integrated schools versus a predominantly Hispanic school, and thinking about what the algebra course taking opportunities are for students. And so within integrated schools, we found that there were about 35% of students who were taking algebra in the eighth grade, compared to only 23% of students in predominantly Hispanic schools. So looking across school types, we realized that there's more algebra taking happening within racially integrated schools. And these are in schools that do offer the course, so that's not a deciding factor in terms of whether students are taking it. All of these schools did have eighth grade algebra as an option. But then when we look within integrated schools, or each school type, within racially integrated schools, we found that there was a great overrepresentation of white students in the course compared to Black and Hispanic students who were underrepresented. And as a matter of fact, white students were taking algebra at a rate that was almost twice that of their Black and Hispanic peers. So like 61% of white students were taking the course versus about 27% of Black and Hispanic students in racially integrated schools. So the descriptive statistics show that white students were clearly advantaged in that way in terms of getting into the course. And then within predominantly Hispanic schools, where Hispanic students were in the majority, white students were still taking algebra at rates that were twice that of their peers, Black and Hispanic peers. So 43% of white students compared to about 22% of Black and Hispanic students. When thinking about what actually predicts this enrollment, we were very, very interested in, like you said earlier, in our research questions, whether these prior racial inequalities explain some of the disparities that we may see later on. And so we did run some models within each of these school types to determine if those prior disparities in academic achievement, for example, were explaining some of these subsequent inequalities if they did exist. And so within integrated schools, at the baseline, we see that Black and Hispanic students are less likely to enroll in algebra than their white peers, which is not surprising given the descriptive statistics. But then when we take social class background into account, some of that disparity is explained, but not completely. But then finally, when we take into account students' prior academic background, so their math grades, their math test scores, or whether or not they were in a seventh grade honors math class, those three together completely explain the disparity. So at the surface, it looks like if all things are equal, social class background and academic background, white, Black, and Hispanic students are equally likely to take eighth grade algebra within integrated schools. Now, thinking about within predominantly Hispanic schools, we do the same thing. And we find that at the baseline, Black students are less likely than both their white and Hispanic peers to be enrolled. And that disparity remains net of social class and academic priors. So within this context, Black students remain less likely to take eighth grade algebra relative to their white and Hispanic peers.
So on itself, that's already just really interesting and kind of troubling to think about, but maybe not totally surprising given what we know about mm-hmm. United States schools and mm-hmm. how race kind of plays into those schools.
Right.
But in the article, you bring in this theoretical lens of a racialized social system, and you kind of use that to think about these school systems.
Yes.
So I was wondering if you could just share a little bit of, like, why did you bring that theory, and what did that theory sort of help you see in this that you might have missed if you hadn't been looking at it from the racialized social system kind of lens?
Yeah, so I really enjoy doing this work because I feel like I can bring a critical lens to what the numbers say, right? And so oftentimes in research studies like this is where the paper ends, right? Okay, in integrated schools, we see that those schools are meritocratic, and if you have the same grades, come from the same background, you have equal opportunity, right? However, if we dig a little bit deeper and we think about these racialized social systems where, unfortunately, Black and Hispanic students are often subject to bias, discrimination, stereotypes, low expectations, watered-down curricula, we need to be thinking about what were those opportunities like prior to entering eighth grade algebra. And if we really truly have a situation where all things are equal, right? And so the statistics say that if all things are equal, we're going to have this equal opportunity, but that's not the reality. And so we really need to be thinking about what's happening prior to enrollment in eighth grade algebra, because we run the risk of just socially reproducing a lot of the disparities that currently exist. And so in the integrated school setting, by thinking about these racialized social systems where Black and brown students are often not given the same educational opportunities that their more privileged white peers are, it stands to reason that clearly their outcomes won't be the same, right? And so if we are not paying attention to those prior instances of inequality, we just continue to reproduce them. And so in this paper, we don't stop by saying all things being equal, yay, we have a meritocratic system. We don't want to be fooled by that and let that be the end story. That's not the end story. The end story is we really have a lot of inequality taking place. And within this particular district, within these particular school types, they're just continuing to be reproduced. And that does not fix the issue that we have in terms of equity. Mm-hmm. The other part of this lens is really thinking about these racialized, racial hierarchies that we have. And so a lot of this, my work is informed by Danny Martin's work and thinking about these hierarchies, racial hierarchies. And this plays out quite a bit in what we find in predominantly Hispanic schools, and this idea that being Black in one context is not necessarily the same as being Black in another context. And so I think that there may be this belief that within a predominantly Hispanic school, right? So the fact that Hispanic and Black students, in terms of thinking about racial hierarchies, occupy a space that's insubordinate to white students, for instance, that we would expect that within predominantly Hispanic schools that there would be something protective, if you will, about being Black in that context, simply because you both groups come from, you know, these minoritized populations. But what we find is that that's not the case. And so we need to be thinking about how these hierarchies play out within these particular school contexts, and what that means for real experiences for real children. And so specifically thinking about Black students in a predominantly Hispanic school context, Black students are at a huge disadvantage when it came to taking this particular gatekeeping course. And so when we step back and look at the data and look at the findings and use this particular lens, we're able to tell a more holistic story and unpack what these numbers actually mean.
So having done that analysis, the top level, but also digging deeper in these ways that you're talking about, what's the main idea that you're kind of left with, or the takeaway that you have having conducted that study?
Oh, main idea. there are a number of things, I guess, I take away from this. One of them is that we don't know enough. Mm-hmm. And I think that sometimes we say, yeah, we know that there's inequality. Yes, we know that this is the case. Yes, we know that students from minoritized populations are not getting the same opportunities. Yes, 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 we know this. But I think it's still important for us to know, or to have a more nuanced look into, within what context do we see what happening? So what are the patterns within these different contexts? And specifically thinking about school racial composition, given that we know, you know, our schools are becoming much more segregated now than they were before. And so really thinking about what those experiences look like for students of color, and then not making assumptions that, you know, being Black or Hispanic means the same thing in one context as it does in another. So that's one huge takeaway. And then the other is really thinking about Black students in general, right? And so racialized hierarchies, right? Danny Martin talks a lot about how Black students are positioned in education. And unfortunately, Black students occupy like the bottom rung of the ladder. And we really need to be paying closer attention to what those educational experiences are for our Black students in a way to disrupt and interrupt some of these really troubling patterns that we're seeing across contexts. Mm-hmm.
Charisma Morton is at the University of North Texas. Charisma, thanks so much for sharing those insights onto the study. People can find the article in Volume 50 of JRME. I also, though, want to ask you a different sort of question. You mentioned teaching in the past, in math teaching, and now, you know, working in math education in the academic field. Can you imagine doing something else if you weren't in math education?
Absolutely. I often daydream about this. So, you know, I don't know about you, but sometimes we have these conversations, you know, when you get frustrated, you have a really bad day or something. And so my go-to daydream job would be to have a bakery. Mm-hmm. And so I really enjoy baking. Mm-hmm. I'm not an expert by any means, but I watch many YouTube videos and I see how other people decorate cakes and the like. And so my sisters and I have a dream that, you know, maybe one day we will make a reality of just opening a family bakery, mm-hmm. and making cakes and making people very happy.
Yeah, and good smells and kind of a nice environment.
Exactly.
So with cake baking, you can kind of do that any time of day, right? But yes. Like other bakery, you know, open very early. Are you like a morning person who can get
am.
Up, you know, and have... Okay, so that
I
can work too.
I am a morning person. Although if I weren't, it could be a late night bakery, right? I mean, you could
That's
always push the
midnight
envelope
cookies
a little
and
bit.
Stuff. Mm-hmm. Well, Charisma, thanks so much for taking the time to do this. It was a real fun joy to talk to you.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me. I really enjoy talking about this paper. Thank you.